This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This month, college freshmen are moving into new dorms, meeting their roommates, buying textbooks, and starting classes. For lots of them, college is their first extended time away from home. But what they leave behind isn't just an empty bedroom. It's also often a new and quickly growing pile of debt. These days, a college diploma can cost $200,000 or more. For many families, that's just too much to go it alone. And for this generation of college-bound kids, huge student loan packages are accepted and even expected. But one college student says it doesn't have to be that way. In fact, he says it shouldn't be that way. Zach Bissonette is a senior at UMass Amherst, and he just wrote a financial advice guide called Debt-Free You, How I Paid for an Outstanding College Education Without Loans, Scholarships, or Mooching Off My Parents. Zach, thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
So besides presumably hoping for a bestseller, why did you write this book?
So when I was in high school, I was going through the same situation that most families are, and that's this. We didn't have nearly enough money to send me the kind of dream private college of my choice, but at the same time, we weren't low income enough that we were going to get huge amounts of financial aid. So my situation was that I had to make a choice between going to a cheap in-state public college or borrowing a lot of money to go to a private college. And that's the situation that at least 80% of Americans are in, and that percentage is going up as the cost of college gets higher. And the kind of research that I did into the cost-benefit analysis of which decision was the right one to make was really the foundation for Debt-Free You.
You're 21 years old. You're still in college at UMass Amherst, where you're majoring in art history. Yet you've written a book that dubs you a personal finance expert. So besides just your own experience applying to college, what is it about your own life and life experiences that you think gives you the financial expertise worth sharing with a wider audience?
Sure. Well, you know, when I was younger, my parents had a lot of financial problems, and especially my dad. And it was kind of growing up in that where I kind of had this realization that even if you don't really care about money, you have to worry about it, because if you don't, it will eventually end up becoming all that you think about. And in the introduction to Debt For You, I talk about this conversation I had with my dad, you know, while his house was going through foreclosure. And I said to him, you know, who do you think thinks about money more, you or Bill Gates? And he said to me, oh, definitely me, because I tried to never think about money, and consequently I don't have any, and now it's all I think about, and it's sort of money exacting its cruel revenge on me. So it was sort of that foundation combined with my own sort of entrepreneurial instincts and my interest in finance and all the books I read, you know, starting in like eighth grade, that gave me a background in personal finance.
You cite a lot of chilling numbers in your book. Two-thirds of all students in the U.S. borrow money to pay for college. Average student loan debt more than 20 grand. 70% of parents say they're very concerned about how to pay for their kids' college tuition. Yet you say that paying for college can be much easier than people realize. So give us your elevator pitch, your sort of Cliff Notes version of how this could be true.
The bottom line is that parents need to realize that the single most important thing that you can get in terms of picking a college is to pick one with a low cost where you can do it debt-free. Your kid's not going to earn a return on investment, on average, by going to a better college. There was a study out of Princeton that found that students who were accepted into elite schools but attended less selective colleges actually ended up earning the same amount of money as students who graduated from elite schools. And what that suggests is that if your kid's smart enough and driven enough to get into an elite school, he's going to do great no matter where he goes. And another really important point, because people say to me, you know, I want my kid to go to the best school that he can get into. There's another study that shows that I think it's for every 7 percentile ranks in your college graduating class that you graduate higher, career earnings tend to increase by about 3.5%. So in some sort of perverse way, it might actually make sense to go to a school where you're going to graduate with a higher class rank, because that's correlated with earning more money. And it's not to say that you should go to a crappy school so you can graduate with a high class rank, but that the benefit of being a star at your school may outweigh mostly or even entirely the benefit of going to a better school.
Zach, this is a key piece of advice in your book, that students should attend a state school, a public university. You say people are overly obsessed with Ivy League degrees and that college tuition is outrageously inflated.
And there's another really important point to make here, that comparing the cost of an elite school to a public college, you know, it's not the best example, because if you look at schools like Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Stanford, University of Pennsylvania, Brown, and a few other ones, those are colleges with huge endowments and enormous financial aid packages. So as a practical matter, if you get into those schools, you won't end up graduating with a lot of debt. If you look at a list of the 10 schools where kids leave with the least debt, 5 of them are public colleges, and the other 5 are very, very selective private colleges like Harvard, Yale, and Stanford. And so where kids get into trouble with debt is when they go to the sort of second and third tier private colleges. And so what I say in the book is that if we can talk about and say there might not be any benefit to attending Harvard, you probably won't earn a return on that investment, you probably won't make money by going there, how can you possibly think that it's a good idea to spend the same amount of money, or actually more money because you're not going to get financial aid, to go to NYU? It doesn't make sense.
You also give the counterintuitive advice that you shouldn't trust high school guidance counselors and college admissions officers to give you reliable financial aid info. Why not?
The biggest problem with high school guidance counselors is that they're advising people on making the second largest investment of their entire lives financially behind a house, and they have literally no training in personal finance at all. I mean, they just don't, and it doesn't make them bad people. It's just that their training is not in finance, and they're helping you make a financial decision. And when you go into a financial aid office at a college, their job is to help you come up with the money to give to that school, their employer, and they don't really care about your financial situation. No one cares about your kid's financial future except for you. And you have to go into this college process and deal with these admissions officers and financial aid officers with that in mind.
Zach, you also suggest in your book that college students should work about 30 hours a week while carrying a full course load. I think you say that could earn them about $9,000 a year. But
right.
is that really realistic, especially if you're trying to get something out of your education and make sure you take time to study and do your homework and really
learn
something?
That 30 hours is sort of an average over the course of the year, so I would suggest more during the summer and during vacations and less during the school year. But as a practical matter, there was a study that found that students who work during college actually graduate with higher GPAs than students who don't work. And, you know, when you look at all the data, I think around 20 hours a week is sort of an amount that most students can work without getting into trouble. I mean, the average student studies out of class, I think something like 12 hours a week. So college is not the full-time job that people think it is. The other thing I want to say here is that if you say, you know, I don't want my kid to work while he's in school, you're hurting his chances at succeeding in the job market. Employers want kids who know how to work. One of the top stereotypes about recent college graduates is that they're kind of entitled, that they don't know how to deal with authority in a work situation well. And what better way to disprove all three of those things than to go into your first job interview and be able to say, I worked 2 jobs throughout college and graduated with a 3.6 GPA because I felt that graduating debt-free was the single best thing that I could do for my long-term future. What employer wouldn't be impressed by that? You know, I talked to the head of human resources at a big accounting firm who told me that they would much rather hire people who have work experience than people who have slightly higher GPAs, and that they don't care about relevant work experience. She said, we love to hire people who just graduated with accounting degrees and worked at Starbucks because it shows they know how to work in a fast-paced environment and deal with people. They're not looking for relevant work experience. They just want people who know how to work.
Zach, before you go, you're just starting your senior year at UMass Amherst. You're majoring in art history. What are your plans after college?
You know, who knows? I mean, that's the great thing about being debt-free is that you don't have to have this immediate idea about what you're going to do. You know, you can get a job and you'll figure it out, but you don't have these huge monthly payments that are starting immediately that you have to worry about. That's what I want people to realize, is that you give yourself so much flexibility by doing this debt-free.
Zach Bissonnette, thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
Thanks so much.
Zach Bissonnette is a senior at UMass Amherst and the author of Debt-Free You, How I Paid for an Outstanding College Education Without Loans, Scholarships, or Mooching Off My Parents. We're joined now by Derek Jackson, a columnist for the Boston Globe, who recently wrote an op-ed piece about the upward spiraling cost of college tuition. Derek, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon.
So we just heard, and I'm sure you just heard, a college student decry the cost of higher ed. And as you wrote about in one of your recent columns, it's pretty bad out there financially for college parents and students. And all signs seem to indicate that things are only going to get worse. You even called the cost of college tuition morally inexcusable. So what's behind the ballooning rate of college tuition, which, as you note, is rising well beyond the rate of inflation?
Well, first of all, I got to hand it to Zach. I give him an amen on almost everything he said. The colleges, both public and private, some of this fueled more by the private schools, are in an unprecedented arms race on a whole lot of levels. They're raising their prices, the price of tuition, fees, room, and board at both private and public four-year colleges has risen 3.5 to 4.5 times the increase of family average family income, to the point where the schools are now, it's not just $200,000 a year, they've now hit the $225,000 a year mark for 4 years. And actually, the amount that is spent on education, according to the Delta Cost Project, one of the top think tanks that looks at these things, the actual spending on education itself has actually declined slightly. So what's it going into? It's going into buildings. It's going into there may be obviously some legitimate operational costs that have gone up with inflation, but there's colleges are scrambling all over themselves to build fancier buildings to attract folks. One example is you look at the sports teams. The NCAA just put out a report last month, as an example, that despite the billions and billions of dollars of television contracts that colleges participate in, only 14 out of the 120 schools that participate in the bowl championship series of the top bowls make money. And in fact,
so the money goes into them, but there isn't much of a return on investment.
Not only that, the losses in just 1 year from 2008 to 2009 have increased from $8.2 million to $10 million.
So it doesn't sound like money well spent. Listeners, we're talking about the fast rising cost of college education, and we want to know how much you think is too much. Where do you draw the line? Do you draw it at your retirement account, or are you willing to dip into that? Are you willing to get a second mortgage, a second job? Are you willing to send your kid to a state school, or do you feel that the Ivy League degree is important? What do you think can be done to reel in tuition prices? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Derek Jackson at The Globe, you just were talking about the arms race, as you call it. It's that keeping up with the Joneses mentality of needing fancier athletic facilities and ritzier dining halls and swankier dorms. But of course, kids love that stuff. So are you saying that the downside of it is it ends up padding the tuition bill maybe without an academic return?
Oh, absolutely. I think the time has come, I think, particularly for parents to ask themselves, is that $50,000 a year school really going to make your kid 3 times happier than a $17,000 state school? And I think as Zach eloquently said, citing statistics as if he was an op-ed columnist himself, the data itself says that there's virtually no difference. There's no difference really in income down the road. The bottom line, I think, which has been lost in this equation of helicopter parents and keeping up with the Joneses and being seduced by fancy names and fancy facilities, is that parents are forgetting, I think, to transmit to kids the very basic lesson of, you will make out of the education what you do when you get there.
And that we may be deluding ourselves about whether the name matters, whether the pedigree matters.
I just have to say, as a commuting school product myself, I have to speak up for public outlet.
Derek, where did you graduate from?
University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, 26,000 students, and we dropped football in my freshman year.
Derek Jackson of The Globe, you also say that the problem is only going to get worse. You raise this prospect of maybe $500,000 tuition tab within the next 20 years. Do you think that's where we're headed?
Without the college presidents getting together, without I think some serious bully pulpit behavior from the White House, yeah, we're headed there. Those figures come from the chair of Columbia University's religion department that it'll be the cost of college will be $500,000 by 2028.
That's got to make anybody swallow hard and wonder how in the world do you save for something like that? It's almost unsavable. There's got to be something other than just socking money away to cover that kind of bill.
That's right.
Listeners, again, we're talking about the rising cost of college education. It's getting higher and higher all the time, and how much people put into trying to pay for it, mortgaging their homes, dipping into their retirement accounts. We want to know how you pay for college, whether you think it's going too high, whether you feel like it's time to push back at the Ivy League schools and consider putting your kid into state school. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have a call from Ed from Wenham. Hi, Ed, and thanks for calling Radio Boston.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
Great show. This is falling particularly hard on the unemployed, the underemployed, and the freelance people like me. And one of the difficulties is that this is really falling much more squarely on our kids. I have a 19-year-old, beautiful girl, who has gotten herself into Salem State, found herself an apartment, lowered her costs as much as she could, and is, you know, doing this on her own hook. But it's not easy. And she doesn't. There aren't, a second mortgage to fall back on, or 401k or any of that, because those just don't exist in our world anymore. And what that's not being communicated effectively, I don't think, to the seniors in high school. I know some of my daughter's younger friends certainly, you know, are struggling to figure out what is it I'm going to do, how I'm going to pay for this. My parents can't help me.
Sure, and how, Ed, that debt might affect their choices when they get out of college, the bills they're going to have, the student loan bill on top of an apartment rental and that sort of thing. Thanks for that call, Ed. That's an important point. So, Derek, what about that? I mean, when we put this in the climate of the current economy, it's even more of a crisis. I mean, you call this a national emergency. You say colleges need to be held accountable. How should they be held accountable?
Well, that's a very good question, and holding them accountable is, you'd like to think that the college presidents could get together and do that themselves. I don't know. I mean, you don't want to have the government telling colleges exactly what to do, but you've got a sort of a double whammy here. You have private colleges that have the resources to engage in an arms race to the point where in 2002, for instance, there were no private colleges paying their presidents more than $1 million
in
salary.
And now that's typical for administrators.
Now at least 23 colleges, private colleges, pay their presidents $1 million. So you can see the mentality that probably is reflected in that down the rest of what they do in their buildings. Now, state schools are in a separate bind, because they are beholden to state legislatures for the most part, and in this budget crunch, they've lost money in most states, you know, from appropriations from legislatures. So they have no choice. Fat aside, they have no choice but to raise fees and tuitions to their students. So it frankly calls for a national debate conference that the president has to call.
Sure. We have also another call that I'd like to hear from. This is Subu from Lexington. Subu, thanks for calling. I understand you think that college education should be treated like a business investment.
That's correct. Actually, there's no point blaming the school or the academics or government or anything like that. We are living in a global economy today, which means all kids who go to college and all their parents should treat education in two tracks. One is academic education, which United States schools are the very best in the world. Mm. The second, they also have to treat it as a business investment. What is it that they're going to get out of the school? When they get out of it, what jobs that they're going to go for? Very much like what Zach was doing, one has to really plan ahead and put every piece of it together as if they're a small business.
Right.
Person.
So take a very clinical approach to it. Subu, thank you for that call. Derek, we don't have a lot of time left, but can you tell me briefly, what advice do you have for parents and students who are facing these tuition bills?
Oh, yeah. First of all, really sit down with your kid and with your conscience and start from the point of, I'm not going to get involved in an arms race. I'm going to get involved in having discussion with my child as to what their current goals are, and how will a college choice, you know, affect those goals. And also, I think I so rarely hear in just listening to, various friends and whatnot over time, you know, what is going to make the kid happy.
Right, exactly.
I mean, and yeah.
Exactly. And Derek, you know, I think I'm hoping actually we can revisit this issue later in the year. For now, I think we've run out of time, and I'm sorry we have, but I appreciate that you came on, and I hope you'll come back eventually and talk more with us about it. Derek Jackson is a columnist with the Boston Globe. We're about to take a break, but when we come back, can't make it to the synagogue for high holidays? Well, some Boston area rabbis are offering a 21st century alternative. Also, Dresden Dolls front woman Amanda Palmer joins us to talk about her new show at the ART in Cambridge. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back.